With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the latest Motorsport Magazine issue preview podcast. This is where members of the editorial team for the magazine run through the latest issue and give readers a little insight, hopefully, into how the magazine came about and pull out some of our personal highlights from each issue. Podcast, we will be doing a double header. We've got two magazine issues to get through. The first one is the October issue, and after that we will look at the November issue, which is in the shops from today, I think it is. Anyway, going back a month, if we can all cast our minds back, let's look at the October issue. To discuss it, I'm joined by the features editor, Simon Aaron, our staff writer, Sam Cannell, our digital editor, Jack Phillips, and our art director, Damon Cogman. Gang, what a cover. I mean, I know it's not on sale anymore because it's just come off the newsstands, but that really is something else, isn't it? It's a picture of the, well, it's the Holy Trinity, as we're calling them, the Ferrari 512, the Lola T70, and Porsche 917, all on track together and driven by Dario Franchitti. Damon, what do you think of that cover?
Not all at the same time, I hasten to add. He's good, but he's not that good. I mean, what a cover, eh? Can we just have that on sale for another month?
Because it is in the app, of course.
Ah, yes, that's a good point, yes.
This is a very good point by our digital editor, Jack, who says that it is
intercepted straight away, isn't it?
Tell us how you go about getting it on the app then, Jack.
Well, if you go to the App Store, your App Store, whichever one, whether that's Android or iOS, you can then just search for Motorsport, put a space, and then we should come up, and then you can then download the issue and subscribe, I believe, from inside the app.
Right. And you can download individual issues, can't you?
Yes, and there are some from the full archive as well, so back to the 30s, believe.
Okay. You're saying that with slight...
Well, I believe so.
Yeah.
It's all online.
Aren't you the digital editor? Shouldn't you know these things?
Yeah.
All right, back on topic.
that was good work. We literally went 10 seconds before we deviated out. That was even for us, that was good work.
Damon, just talk us through this cover. I mean, just tell us from an artistic point of view, what makes it so striking?
Well, the first thing is obviously a big red Ferrari. You can't really go wrong with that, really. It's sort of a 512, which is an unbelievably beautiful car to start with. So you're off to a good start there. Yeah, and it's very rare to have a track test where a 917 is in a supporting role. Usually it's front and centre, but the amazing thing about these particular cars is that they're all worthy of a cover by themselves. But having all three makes it probably, what, three times better, I suppose, isn't it?
Absolutely.
At least, by the power of three. And visually it's striking. It's on an angle. We've beefed up the colours. We've turned it from a slightly grey overcast Donington afternoon into a sort of a slightly more moody feel to it. But I think it leaps off the shelves, hopefully, or it will have done by the time you listen to this. So.
And Simon, just talk us through just briefly a little bit about what makes these particular cars so special, and why it's so sort of rare to see them all three together at the same time.
Well, I mean, the reason it's special for one reason is simple scarcity, because although we do see these cars out and about at historic events, it's not often that you get the chance to see all three of them running in such close proximity at the same time on the same day. They hark back to such a fabulous era of sports car racing when sports car racing today is quite innovative, certainly compared with Formula One. The rules are less prescriptive, but back then, I mean, this was before the 3-litre limit was imposed, and wasn't quite anything goes, but they were real beasts. you know, 5 litre V8s, V12s. I mean, the flat 12s. They were, you know, they were monsters of cars. And if you talk to the drive guys who race them in period, they'll tell you all sorts of harum scarum stories about developing the things. And they weren't just fast and powerful, but they look absolutely beautiful.
Darek couldn't believe his luck that day, could he?
No, absolutely. he said, you know, it was real sort of.
Boyhood dream, isn't it?
Yeah. Boy's own stuff.
Yeah, if we can list all the...
Particularly for somebody like Dario, who's a real student, as well as a very successful racing driver in his own right, he's a real student of the sport. I mean, he loves finding out about his past, and there's no better place to find out about his past than in the driving seat of those three.
Yeah. You mentioned there the people who drove them in period. Jack, not many people drove all three cars, but I notice here you managed to find one.
Yeah, it took us a while to work out, to put our finger on David Hobbs, because a lot of people drove two, but not many people drove all three. I think it was Hobbs and Jackie Oliver, the only two.
Right.
And Hobbs, being such a good talker as he is, was happy to talk as he drove across America in and out of signal.
I didn't realise he was at the wheel when you spoke to him.
Yeah.
Hands-free.
You had to ring him back about four times as you're going through various tunnels.
It would just go dead silent, and then he would be mid-sentence and I'd have no idea what he was talking about and then have to call him back. But we got there in the end. So
no, it's a great... He gives a wonderful insight into what it was like. Damon, before we move on, I just wanted to mention these rather lovely... cutaway pictures that we've got of each of the cars, showing the kind of under the skin of them. They're great, aren't they? And they look like they were done in period.
I mean, with the style of the day, it was very much an artist's kind of eye for the under the skin. So although they're kind of seen as technical drawings, they're still an artistic endeavor. The sort of more technical drawings that we have today, very much based around computer generated images, and it is very much fact based and information based, whereas the cutaways of the 60s, 70s and even further back were really, really kind of part of a... They were done by artists. They were done by people that kind of had an artist's eye, not necessarily they had the full technical backdrop to every sort of nut and bolt. And there was a lot of artists' sort of leniency in amongst all of that. But yeah, I think what it does is it gives it a real kind of warmth as well as all the kind of you're looking into this sort of into the heart and soul of these machines. You get a real kind of a beauty to it, which I don't think you really get with the cutaways of today.
No, I mean, there is an artistry in the engineering as well, isn't there? And that it's just wonderful. I mean, I'm sure if you've got the magazine in front of you, just pause for a moment on those images. I think they're wonderful. But look, I'm gonna jump ahead because we've got a lot to get through. We've also got a feature here on the Goodwood revival. Simon, is it really 20 years? 20 years since the first revival, it seems like.
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned it in my piece, but it's it really resonated with me when Goodwood reopened, because I've been there so many times earlier on in my writing career. We'd base road car shoots from around there, because A, it had a nice cafe, which was a good place to meet, and B, you're on the fringe of the South Downs, which is a good place to take cars for photo shoots. And I always used to look out and think what a pity it was that I'd never seen racing there. And there'd be testing and stuff going on, but you never imagined that racing would resume, just because there was no logical reason for it to resume. And then when Lord March made his announcement in the mid-1990s, as broken exclusively in motorsport, I should add.
You were a news hound, weren't you?
Well, yeah, sort of. There was a feature that actually broke a news story. It was quite an unusual hybrid, but, you know, and he said he was going to do it. And I remember so vividly standing there in 1998 on the other side of the pit straight, looking down from the chicane down towards Madwick, as all the ERAs, a couple of BRMs kind of stuttered off the line and stopped. But there were ERA is another sub, but it was a nice smoky, oily start, and it just seemed a very appropriate way for Goodwood to burst back into life with all this smoke and haze, and it was a gorgeous autumnal afternoon. And that seems like 3 minutes ago, 2 minutes ago. And the fact that 20 years have passed, and that moment is still imprinted on my mind, and I think it always will be.
I've still got my flat cap that I wore on that day as well.
In 1998.
So, yes, it still fits me. It's the only, you probably
paid a schoolboy rate to get in, didn't you? I had my press pass. To have gone from that, and it was a well-attended event back then, and everyone said, well, it's lovely, but it's nothing like Goodwood, because Goodwood is all oily, mucky puddles like every other racing circuit. But yeah, the way it has evolved into... I still love it as a race meeting, but it's almost like a theme park in some ways, in a good way. But the people who go aren't necessarily racing fans. They just like to be part of a major event. And in much the same way as the Grand National or a Lord's Test match or the Henley Regatta, you know, people who go to those events aren't necessarily aficionados of horse racing or Wimbledon tennis, for example. But yeah, they go and have a great time because it's a fantastic event, and it remains so.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the 70th anniversary of Goodwood the other day, actually, in this year, chock full of them. And on the web, there's a nice little story on that. So, yeah, if you go to motorsportmagazine.com and just have a little search around.
But that's an interesting point, Sam. And it's also now interesting that Goodwood has been operational for longer as a retro venue than it was as a contemporary venue in period, only by a couple of years, but it's had a longer life now in the modern age than it had first time around.
Well, we asked various people to sort of to celebrate it by telling us and recounting their favourite memories of the revival, and we've got a whole raft of names, of course, including many of our staff members here. We've got Gordon, we've got Simon, obviously, Andrew Frankel and Dickie Meaden. We've also got Tom Christensen, Matt Neal, Martin Brundle. Lovely kind of package, really, of great memories from down the years. One of the things we always like to try and do is pull together a story which you don't necessarily expect to be hoving into view. And this month, or the last month, we've got a piece on the Bend racetrack, which is in Australia, and it's been built by a millionaire businessman down there who's also an enormous motor racing fan, and it is it's an extraordinary kind of undertaking, really, and we've had our Australian correspondent go down and take a look at it. It's just south of Adelaide in the middle of nowhere, and makes a lovely read. We've also got Dickie Meaden taking part in a single make or in the Porsche 2 litre cup, which is sort of it's unusual, isn't it, Simon? Because it's a sort of there's not many single make historic racing series.
No, I mean, relatively few, and a lot of people think that one make racing has completely spoilt the sport in some respects. But you know, I wouldn't want to see one make racing become the norm in historics, because part of the beauty of historic racing is the extreme diversity you get. But I think something like this, they're nice, elegant cars. There are lots of them, yeah, and they provide good racing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, let's not forget Howard. Of course,
yes. It was the first time a member of Take That has appeared in motorsport, I believe.
This has got to be a world's first, hasn't it? Surely, in the 95-year history, I'm sure we haven't quite ever broached the subject of.
We're a broad church, Damon.
Yes,
and we encompass. He was absolutely brilliant, wasn't he? He was very generous with his time and with his car. And when we interviewed him, he actually obviously knows a lot about racing, yeah, and takes it pretty seriously. He tweeted actually after we published it, saying he couldn't believe it made the pages of Motorsport magazine. So, very briefly, Simon, because we've got to move on. Scott Pruitt, our lunch with you, met him for breakfast.
At Goodwood, it was a beautiful morning, sitting on the terrace of the aforementioned old cafe. Not met Scott before. Delightful guy. Fantastically successful career, particularly in sports car racing in the States, but he also won Champ Car races, Trans Am races, you name it, he's been there, done it. podiums in NASCAR. Which all
pales into significance.
Alongside the fact he's got a vineyard.
apart from the fact that you introduced him into his first ever British breakfast, didn't you?
Well, I did, yeah. I mean,
they don't have sausages in America, really, do they?
I think he had a sausage.
No bangers.
He had a sausage and egg toasted sandwich, which he ate most of, but he only weighs about 55 kilos, so I think
kind of poked it around his plate and sort of
he did eat most of it, but fascinating guy. And in the piece he recommends one particular wine from his vineyard, which I looked up online and discovered cost about $150 a bottle, so it probably is very, very good.
Christmas present for you, Simon, after he reads this. Right, we're gonna leave the October issue there and move on to the current issue, which is on sale. Before we do, I would like to mention it's a first for motorsport. It's our very own track day, which is taking place on October the 5th. This is open to all readers. You can go to our website and you'll be able to find out some more information. But the headline figures are that you can bring your own car. We get a full driver safety briefing. There's several allotted driving sessions throughout the day. There's a welcome from our special guest and friend of the magazine, Tiff Nidell. Professional driving tuition with I think four licensed instructors. We have breakfast, lunch, afternoon tea as well, and most importantly, you get to meet members of the editorial team between sessions out on the track. So if that appeals, go to the website. Find out more details, and we look forward, hopefully, to seeing you on the 5th of October at Thruxton. Now, moving on to the current issue, which is on sale. A Jaguar E-Type on the cover, and it looks really rather splendid, Damon.
It does look good, doesn't it? An E-Type is... you're on safe ground there, really, aren't you? I mean, everybody loves an E-Type. It is a fantastic-looking
machine. But there's something
special
machine about this particular, yes, E-Type.
This one's got a hell of a story attached to it. So, obviously, we're not going to... Well, they all do. They all do, yes. But we're obviously not going to let all the cats out of all the bags for this particular one. But there's quite an interesting story that follows it through its entire career, through its whole life.
Yes, and it's the way that we've shot it, it looks like it's coming back to life.
The lovely thing is, obviously, with Lyndon, our star photographer, did a lovely job. We sent him off to Goodwood, and I think he was photographing at about 10 o'clock at night, but at the point we still see it there. So I think he was quite pleased to get it done. But I think after the team basically threw him the keys and said, just put a cover over it when you finished, and kind of left him to it for the night.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
So he was left to his own devices for a while.
Fantastic. I'm just going to pause, actually, just going through the pages here on historic news. Obviously, we've got before that, we have Mark Hughes talking about the Formula One season. We've got the international news and our columnists. But historic news, interesting story, Sam. And you're making the point here that there might well be too many historic races on the calendar.
Well, yeah, it's not just me making the point. We had a few candid chats with the outgoing HSCC CEO, Graham White, who's actually now been replaced by Andy D. Crown. There's more on that in the next one. But, there's some really candid chats, like bringing up Brexit. I know we try and shy away from that in this particular magazine, yes. But it is the elephant in the room. Too many meetings. It's quite an intriguing one.
Is this something that you've heard sort of on your beat as you go around the various historic meetings that you go to? This is something which has been rumbling for a while, but you've picked it up, yeah?
A lot of people have been saying it's not the same. You know, I mean, the hot topic is based on the Gold Cup as well, and you can see that the Gold Cup is now not what it used to be. I mean, everyone knows that. It's pretty obvious. Yeah. But there are so many factors why. I mean, it's hard to tell if historic racing is in a slump or if it's stagnant. But there are some good reasons why here. So, yeah, it's an intriguing one.
But the problem that we should be saying is that because there are so many historic meetings, it's having an impact on grid numbers.
Yeah, the value of the cars. And, of course, yeah, there's so many conflicts. I mean, why would you compete in maybe the Gold Cup if you could save your car for the revival? It does make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's an issue that's probably going to rumble on, and we're going to keep abreast of it as much as we can, because it's such a growing. I mean, historic racing is now a massive business, and it's a massive sport, and I can only see it going one way at the moment. I mean, Simon, have you heard much about you people worrying that there's just simply too crowded a calendar?
Well, not least me, because you can't be in two or three places at once, and the number of times in the last year or three that there'll have been the HSCC Super Prix at Brands Hatch on the same weekend as the Festival of Speed at Goodwood, and there's a major historic race meeting at Manicourt, which is not that far away. There are constant clashes. This weekend just passed, I mean, there was an HSCC event on at Brands Hatch, great racing, and there was a VSCC meeting at Snetterton, which is only 90 minutes, 2 hours up the road.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people who want to go to both of those things, you know, it's just until the TARDIS is invented, we're stuck.
Yeah,
it does feel as though a lot of the meetings I've been to recently, they're kind of stretching over 2, maybe 3 days, and it feels like it's a one-day event stretched over 2 and indeed 3.
That definitely happens.
And I'm not quite sure why that's happening. So you're having to make choices about going to an event, and you're kind of thinking, well, do I go for 1 day? Do I go for 2 days? Do I go for 3 days? 3 days is a huge commitment for a normal person.
Yeah, no, 3 days at Alton Park for me is fine. But I do accept he did say normal, which
he did caveat it with normal person.
Yeah.
So just running through the magazine, we've got a column. I've lighted here on the letters page, and there's possibly my favourite letter.
Ever. it's brilliant.
Simon, go on, tell us what this letter is talking
about. It came completely out of the blue. A chap emailed him and sent in two shots from Silverstone paddock in 56 or 59, I can't remember which, but anyway,
59 it was, yeah.
59, of Maria Teresa De Filippis in a Maserati 250F, and one was taken by the chap who wrote in, the other was taken by his wife. They'd been standing next to each other, clearly, from the pictures, but they didn't actually meet each other for another 3 or 4 years. And when they did meet, it was in Lagos, in Nigeria. And it was only when they were, after they'd been married for some time, they were looking through their respective photo archives and discovered that they'd both taken the same picture from, you know, what can only have been a few feet away. But, you know, without having any clue at the time that the other party existed. I just think it's a lovely, lovely little throwaway line. It's a
fantastic letter and lovely pictures. And Alec and Jocelyn Raitt, who wrote in, thank you very much indeed. It gave us a lot of pleasure here in the office. Just running through the rest of the magazine here, we've got obviously our cover feature, which is obviously on our E-Type, and also on the Kinrara Trophy, which was the world's build as the world's most valuable race. And so we sort of delve into that and examine why that would be so. And from the revival, we're going jumping right forward to the future and to the digital revolution, written by Jack. You've done a lovely piece on the growing popularity of esports. Maybe just explain briefly, first of all, what esports actually are.
Esports is basically just people playing computer games, which sounds simple, but they are so good nowadays that people are effectively racing against professional drivers. You've got people like Max Verstappen and Niki Team. Lots of other racing drivers spend their time at home playing computer games on their expensive rigs and on their machines.
And this is where you can play live action. This is multiplayer games where you can play in real time other players who are also playing against
all you. Online, and there are now a sort of series of leagues and championships and different race events have cropped up, including British GT, WEC has its own, and now Formula One has joined the party.
Go on, tell us about Formula One, because this is the best. I mean, you nose off on this really rather surreal kind of occasion.
It was a bizarre day. We had to go across to West London to watch basically some Formula One teams pick some kids to represent them in computer game Formula One World.
It's kind of like a draft, isn't it? From like the American sports kind of draft.
I would say it's more like school PE.
In what way?
It was just
people being left against the last person standing
pretty
against
much.
The wall,
and
which no one wanted. At
the end, yeah, and you could see the kids were just all the. Some of them were sort of in their 20s and 30s, sort of sheepishly looking side to side while they didn't get picked. And
And just to be clear, these were proper. These were Formula One teams. These were all the Formula One teams, minus Ferrari, who decided not to play.
They did.
Ball.
They were being Ferrari, and some of them have taken it very seriously. And one of them, I believe, I was told on the night, has taken it slightly less seriously and used part of their IT team to run it. So. But I focus more on the wider picture rather than the specifics of that actual championship, because it is kind of taking over a little bit. And a point made by Jean-Luc Vergne in a house in West London owned by the team running Sauber, which is as bizarre as that evening was as well.
Right.
He said these people aren't doing it to be racing drivers. They are doing it just to be good at computer games, the same way that if you're playing FIFA, you don't expect to be Messi, which is a good point, and it's sort of goes up against what Darren Cox and the GT Academy tried to do, well, and successfully did, in made a racing driver from a computer game driver. So it's quite an interesting. Yeah.
But the modern version of this now is that that sporting people are paid huge sums of money at the esports arena. Not motor racing yet, but in other environments are hugely well paid, aren't they? This sort of
It's all organic as well. It's all been done on their own. They've all done off the back of just YouTube, and you see, they are simple videos that they're earning their money off, and advertising and sponsors, and then they get sponsorship deals from people like Logitech, and now they're getting paid by racing teams as well.
I guess that this is in its infancy, isn't it? This is very much the first sort of wave for
it is.
Motor
That's
racing.
Probably maybe 5 years now, which in the grand scheme of motorsport is not a very long time at all. But in
but
the modern
the growth era rate is phenomenal. I mean, arguably this is the fastest growing.
Yeah, they're talking billions.
Form of motorsport. I mean, in the old days, it used to be karting, where you earned your spurs, and that's where that's the sort of funnel that brought people into the sport. But increasingly, I think people are seeing computer games and esports as that sort of first step.
Yeah, it's quite a surreal thing to watch. I think when we went to the Nürburgring earlier in the year, there was a little arena there, and you could see these people playing computer games, and all you could hear was the click of the pedals. And on the TV, you could see them racing a TCR race around the Nürburgring.
Right.
But all you could—it was silent in the arena, apart from wheels and pedals clicking. So it's not a spectator sport live, but online. I think it probably is.
I don't think it was ever designed to be a spectator sport, really. But it is becoming so, isn't it? You're watching on a screen.
Yeah, I could watch a stream online.
You're watching a stream. You're not watching a live event. No.
20 people with headphones sat.
Yeah, it's a curious thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's also worth mentioning that, you mentioned the FIFA game earlier, Jack, but I mean, Premier League football teams in the UK have got their own virtual football teams as well, and they're paying big money to sort of 15 and 16-year-olds with unnaturally dexterous fingers to represent them in major electronic competitions.
Live on Sky Sports as well. Yeah, they've spent a whole day of live.
I still don't think
FIFA
it's a spectator sport.
No.
I'd far rather watch Altrincham than virtual football.
Let's not be hasty.
To compliment our piece on esports, we have also just a gaze into our crystal ball, really, looking at the future of motor racing. And we've got these are the images that were leaked, I think, last week from an event at the Singapore Grand Prix. Which Ross Brawn was giving a presentation about what was going to happen under the new regulations in 2021. These images came out, images of various kind of design concepts and of Formula One cars. And they looked remarkably like the Generation 2 Formula E cars, I thought. That's not to say that it's a bad thing. I thought they looked pretty good. But what do I know? We asked John Barnard and Steve Nichols to give their opinion, and they were slightly less complimentary, weren't they, Simon?
Well, I think they are both very bright, practical men, and they know that these are the Formula One cars as envisaged by graphic designers rather than by, you know, technical directors. So, you know, I think they looked at it from that. They mentioned certain things that they'd both like to see. Well, they different things that they'd like to see. I won't give away all the details, but there are certain key aspects that they feel should be removed completely in order to make the cars more raceable,
yeah.
Which is, you know, doing away with all the aero widgets that...
Both of them clearly couldn't bear the front wings, and these designs don't address that issue at all, and don't address the issue.
I thought it was quite funny actually that you mentioned these. I mean, these drawings we have, these were the official ones that were released a couple of days after, because they held this thing in Singapore and showed some of the concepts, and would seem quite surprised that somebody used a mobile phone to take a picture of them and put it on Twitter, where it probably got retweeted Formula a zillion is, times. And so it's Formula One's slight lack of grasp of social media.
There was that sort of pause, wasn't there? The images sort of leaked. They were all over social media. Nothing from Formula One. And then sort of 24 hours later, out came all the images. It does seem that they were caught on the hop slightly.
It's a very mobile desk, I thought. We're used to online scrambling, so cover things, whereas this was the day before deadline.
Yeah, that was it. I think we'd actually already designed the feature without any of this stuff involved, and then all of a sudden it was, hang on a minute, stop, let's go back and have another look at this.
Yeah. Yeah, there is, we were right up to date for once.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What else have we got? Just as you can hear, I'm flicking through our pages. Oh, yes, ancient and modern. Look, we've got Sebastian Prelo, Seb Prelo, in Jim Clark's old Lotus Cortina, which actually we was up for auction, so we managed to get... we were offered a ride in it, and we said, yeah, we'd love to have a drive and take it on the track, but we want to do something else. What can we do? And then we all sort of brainstormed it for a bit, and thought, wouldn't it be good to get a kind of a young, up-and-coming racing driver, Sebastian Prelo's Formula 4 driver, to test out and to see whether they can actually handle an old analog racing car. Many people think that younger drivers are a bit mollycoddled at the moment and are spoiled with power steering and flappy pedal, semi-automatic.
I think Seb was a little flummoxed by that big stick sticking out the floor.
What is it?
Yeah. isn't it right that most Formula One drivers now have never driven a sort of a manual gear shift, because everything's with obviously in high performance road cars.
Karting, there's no,
then they come up through the junior ranks.
Formula Renault's got paddle shift. Formula 3's got paddle shift. Formula 2's got paddle shift.
So,
in Formula 4, Seb Prio's got paddle shift.
I think the last one would have been about Ricciardo, because he did Formula Ford back when it was Formula Ford, which was stick.
So there's probably a whole generation of people staring at that stick coming out of the ground going, what's that for?
And their Porsches will all
be... And as you say, even their road cars will be gifted to them. It will be high-performance paddle shift.
So we did throw him in at the deep end to put him in a hugely expensive one-off.
Right. He acquitted himself very well, didn't he? His dad, Andy, was there as well, obviously. And in a way, I think Andy's kind of take on it is almost the most revelatory, in the sense that he's just saying... Look here, son. This is really important. Right? You won't ever forget this. This is Jim Clark's car.
I think there was a moment towards the end of the day where they were kind of having that little sort of father-son moment of having you've got to realize what you've done today, because this stuff isn't going to come around very often. And I think the two of them were kind of had a little sort of a quiet moment together at the end, just to kind of recap, and I'm sure Seb will look back in 20 years' time and remember that day very fondly.
Yeah, it's lovely, and lovely images of a sort of sun-drenched, it was Goodwood actually, sun-drenched Goodwood track. Damon, look, talk us through this next feature, which is a sort of picture essay, really, giving a really interesting glimpse into a very famous incident, but it gives you a kind of angle that you probably readers won't have seen before.
Yeah, again, it's one of those things where it kind of came out of nowhere, really, where an old sort of photographer chum of mine from many moons ago, Lawrence Baker, was given a job by Mercedes to go and cover the Le Mans race from 20 years ago. And obviously we all know that we it's not a spoiler alert to remind everyone what happened. The things flew up in the air and kind of ended up in trees. And
this was 1999.
And it was kind of a huge point in motor racing history, not least for the fact that Mercedes have sort of never been back, although they've had a hugely successful F1 sort of period. We are reminded that before that they hadn't sort of really done very much for a long time because of this event. So Lawrence was very much a part of the team behind the scenes, so he was tasked with photographing all the drivers and the team and the kind of the build up and the excitement and what Mercedes thought would be a glorious victory and the kind of a huge marketing and media extravaganza that would come from winning at Le Mans. But as it turned out, it was somewhat slightly askew of that. So the images are kind of not seen before. They've been Lawrence tucked away in a cupboard when Mercedes asked him to sort of put them away and never show them again.
he'd sort of shot them, hadn't he, for the Mercedes sort of in-house magazine. And obviously after the events of that race weekend, where the cars went airborne three times.
Yeah, I think it was three in the end. Yeah.
They obviously, you know, weren't in the mood to celebrate it, so the pictures were unpublished and in Lawrence's attic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until now. And I mean, they're great, aren't they? They just sort of show, you've got this lovely series of images of Mark Webber obviously explaining to the crew,
a very young Gary Watkins in the background.
He's very young Mark Webber.
Yeah, very, yes.
That is Gary Watkins, isn't it? Explaining what happened, and you can see him just with his hand going flat and then pointing skywards.
Upwards. And then this happened.
It took me, but I mean, because I was there covering that race, and seeing these after all that time, apart from seeing a lot of drivers that I know very well looking 20 years younger, they're just very interesting. Because as you say, they haven't been seen before. I mean, the magazine for which they were intended, I used to do features for from time to time, and it got pulled very quickly for some reason.
It's also interesting is even after all this time, we still haven't quite ever found out exactly what went wrong, and we probably never will. But it's one of those great unsolved mysteries that I mean, there are many rumours around, but it's just it kind of carries on having a little bit of interest even all these years later.
And it's strange, isn't it? Because the actual image, it's one of those iconic images that even people who don't follow sports car racing know that image of I think it was Webber's car.
Yeah.
Vertical. In a way, it's become an iconic image of Le Mans, even though it's something that isn't really particularly talked about. But also
we have to mention, of course, that we can buy a set of prints. what we've done is Lawrence has put together a wonderful box set of the best of these prints that you can buy at our shop. motorsportmagazine.com.
Exactly.
Oh, look at that. And so you can sort of select a selection of prints and have them for yourself, but they are pretty stunning.
And completing the set, Rob, our production editor, spoke to Darren Turner, who was there as a reserve driver. He was there, he spoke to him at Bridge, he did the weekend, so he's going to do a driver's eye view of the event this week on the online. So
okay,
you can read it in the mag, read it in the online, and then buy the prints.
Yeah.
Wow, look at this.
Well-oiled machine.
This is a joined-up operation. Slick. I like it, team. Okay, Mark Hughes, he's looked at Ferrari. He's cast his kind of eye over Ferrari, and as we know with Mark, nothing really escapes his attention. He's really looking at the power vacuum that's been left after the untimely death of Sergio Marchionne, and who is going to step in to replace him, specifically where it comes to running the team. I won't go into the details of it, but it's a fascinating kind of political read, which really takes you behind the scenes. And in a way, that's what Mark is so good at. He's in the paddock. He knows the teams. He knows of these powerful political machinations that are going on, and he can explain it. And it reads like a thriller, really. I mean, it really is a must read piece. And then we go right back to the past, back to 1938. Looking at Donington, the Donington racetrack, and where 80 years ago Nuvolari raced in his only Grand Prix on the UK mainland. It's a great kind of, it's one of these moments in history which has kind of been forgotten. I had forgotten about it, but it's explained by John Bailey, who is a scholar of Donington, with some lovely pictures and some lovely kind of first person memories of people that he's sort of dug out from the archives, explaining why this was significant and actually what happened on the day. What else have we got? We've got a lunch with Freddie Spencer. Matt Oxley has done our lunch with Freddie Spencer. Simon, fast Freddie, absolute. I mean, he's an occasional contributor to the magazine, but a complete...
And to the website. Yeah, Jack will mention the website if I don't.
But what a life.
Yeah, I mean, he's he comes from a real sort of golden era of Premier League motorcycle Grand Prix racing. And his achievement in 85 when he was doing the 250s and the 500s, and one occasion, I think it was at Mugello, where he got off one and didn't have time to change his leathers. I mean, a couple of the other riders lingered in the 250 assembly area so that he had time to run across and get on his bike. So he did two back-to-back Grand Prix. I mean, it's just a completely different world from the one in which we live nowadays. And Matt knows Freddie very well. Freddie's opened up to him, and it's just as always with Matt's prose, it's a beautiful read, and it's a great, great story about a great, great rider, whose career ended very abruptly after the world success, didn't
it? Yeah, he just walked away. I mean, he's a really fascinating character as well. The book that he brought out last year, was just it was very unlike a normal motor racing person. He's a special guy.
Yeah,
he sort of sets apart from the normal motorcycle kind of stereotype.
He has a unique take on motorcycling as well, because he watches it, and when he watches it, he kind of gets into the mindset of all the riders at the front, what they're thinking, how they're doing it. And it's really interesting to see him talk about modern motorcycling with his experience and the mental aspect of riding, which is unique, I think.
Yeah. Especially from that generation as well, because the generation he came from were not, with all due respect, but they were not the thinking guys. They were. It was all about emotion and.
You said that.
I did not say that. It was very much a kind of brute force bicycle, motorcycle. Yeah, that's it. It was all about who could be the toughest and who could sort of come back from injury the quickest and who would have the biggest scars and that kind of thing. So it's a real machismo kind of environment, which he always kind of set apart from.
But he does carry that round with him as well. Mm. With his injuries, I think you can see when you speak to him and meet him and shake his hand, and you can see the injuries.
That's it.
Vividly, almost.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned his book, and I thought it was the most extraordinary. I know that Damon Hill got a lot of plaudits, rightly so, a lot of plaudits for his autobiography. But I thought Freddie's book was just extraordinary, and so, as you say, so unlike a kind of standard sporting autobiography, it was almost like a psychological examination. I mean, it's brutally honest as well, in many ways.
Very much so.
Moving on, we have a lovely... Well, it's a new series, actually, which we're going to introduce, called Master Craftsman, which is aimed at celebrating the wonderful craftsmanship that goes on up and down the country in the automobile world. And a lot of these companies have been going for generations, and this one is I think this is the second or third generation of owners who've been running it. Motolita, who create the most extraordinary steering wheels, beautifully handcrafted, and Gordon Cruikshank, our editor at large, has gone along to meet the team behind the company, find out what they do and how they do it. And it's really a sort of, it's kind of it harks back to the kind of golden age when the kind of the whole slow movement of, rather than rushing something, you do it slow and you do it right. And this is basically what these guys are doing with these steering wheels. And the result is a beautiful object, isn't it?
Yeah, we sent Lyndon down to go and photograph it, and it is like kind of stepping back in time. It's from another age, even though they're using sort of obviously state of the art tools and the rest of it. They are still handmade, which is going to be a trademark of all the places that Gordon goes to over the coming months. Yeah. We can hopefully touch on all manner of different places. I think Lyndon's off somewhere else today, so it's going to be a really interesting way to kind of tap into that world.
I see this as a complete antidote to the modern world. It's nowadays a Formula One team can rush release a new side pod in 5 minutes flat to the press of a CAD button, and have it on an aeroplane out to the other side of the world, and you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But to see old-fashioned values like this still deployed, and to such beautiful effect as well, with something like the Motolita wheels.
And we've also got a video online as well. We're doing lots of plugs today, aren't we? But there's also a video of this, which is kind of really illustrates the way that it's done as well. That's all obviously online as well.
And it shows the sort of the care, doesn't it, in the fact that that you know, you don't have to. I mean, you say you had modern machinery, but some of the machinery, although modern, has been made by the guys that actually do the work. So yeah, it's a one-off piece of machinery that kind of cuts the
it does is makes that little divot. That's right. That's it.
Fantastic. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for listening to our podcast. I hope you enjoyed our insight into both of those magazines. The November issue is on sale now. As we said right at the beginning, it's got the Jaguar E-Type on the front. If you already have the magazine and you're a subscriber, I hope you enjoy reading it over the course of the next month. We'll be back in early October to hopefully talk you through the next issue. Thank you and goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.